Assalamu alaikum, everyone. My name is Muhi Khwaja, American Muslim Community Foundation, and today on the Muslim Philanthropy Podcast, we are honored to have Nadine Mustafa, who is a fundraising consultant at Denise Fierce. Welcome to the show, Nadine.
Thanks so much, Muhi. It's so great to be here.
Of course. You know, you're in Texas. Thankfully, the blizzard hasn't been terrible for you, but, you know, just glad that you and your family are safe. So I know it's been a lot to deal with over the last week or so. So thankful that you are able to join us.
Absolutely. It's definitely been a trying week, you know, never a dull moment in Texas, but a global pandemic plus a blizzard was definitely a lot to handle. But we're very grateful and very blessed, but definitely thinking about our fellow Texans this week, and hope that everyone's okay.
Definitely. You know, our paths have crossed a few years back when you were part of Taiba, and I was visiting Houston and got to meet you and Suzanne, the founder, and just a great organization. And we stayed in touch through your transition to Denise Fierce. And in 2020, we had you as part of our Social Impact Accelerator, where you were one of the facilitators and presenters. So we really appreciate you lending your expertise to the community, and it was a great benefit to those who were able to attend.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that was such a pleasure. It's such a great program, and I have to say, you know, I have to do my little plug that the American Muslim Community Foundation, of course, is something that we are so lucky to have in our community. It is, you know, the fund is such a great thing to have. It's really raised a lot of awareness. Donors are really lucky to have this place and this learning resource. So thank you for all the work that you do for our community.
So happy to
be a part of it.
Yeah, thanks for the plug right off the top. Look at you. And yeah, you know, those webinars and are still available. People can find them as a resource. They're recorded. And just a lot of great gems in there, from strategic planning, which is the session that you helped with, to starting your own nonprofit, recruiting a board, marketing, fundraising, everything in between. So we were very fortunate to have you with us there. And then, you know, through just networking and other leaders in the community, we're part of like a resource group that Ghulam Kahar had started. So great to continue to learn with you on a monthly basis and just kind of share our best practices and definitely our frustrations about being in this space. And we'll get a little bit into that later too, but just wanted to preface with just saying how much I appreciate you and your insight in this field.
Thank you, Muhi. And it's, you know, I love that learning circle. It's definitely, you know, such a blessing to be a part of that group, because there's so many diverse backgrounds. And just a safe space for us to share some of the challenges in this space. You know, it's not easy, but we're lucky to have, you know, people like you join us. So.
Yeah, of course. And Mary Whitehill from Mary's List, who was also on the podcast, is also part of that group. And maybe we'll be able to bring the other people from the group on as well throughout the rest of the season. So. Yeah, you know, welcome to the show officially, and tell us a little bit more about who you are.
Sure, can you hear me? Let's make sure my audio is working. We've got some technology today. Okay, so first of all, again, thank you so much for having me. This is such a wonderful opportunity for us from all over the world or all over the U.S. to get together. I love the new technology that we're all connecting through. So thanks again for having me. A little bit about my background. So I like to call myself a nonprofit nerd. I've been in the space for over a decade, everything from the intern to the executive director, and now I'm in the consultant side. So I've been on the board, I've been, you know, kind of in the program side and also on, you know, fundraising side. So I'll talk a little bit about kind of where that career started and a little bit about my educational background as well. I think, you know, often when we're mentoring people in this space, they always ask, how did you become a consultant or how did you get here? It's never a linear path. Unfortunately, we don't just go to school for nonprofit consulting, it's not necessarily a major, right? So, or even nonprofits, sometimes it's nonprofit management, things like that, but it's not the most linear career path. So I'm a Houstonian, born and raised, as Muhi mentioned, Texas. Interesting time to be in Texas right now. But I was born and raised in Houston, but my family is Libyan American. So that's a big part of my kind of activism and advocacy work in the very beginning was kind of democratic awareness, democratic transitions and activism, things like that. So I went to school at St. Agnes Academy. It's an all-girl private Catholic school here in Houston. I like to joke that I have about 8 years of Catholic school experience, so I'm the most Catholic Muslim you've ever met. Been to more Mass than you've ever expect. but that was actually where the seeds were planted for my interest in nonprofits. I actually started in interfaith work. So that was where my passion kind of grew out of, you know, doing these interfaith events, working with Interfaith Ministries, a large nonprofit here in Houston, you know, doing little talks, things like that, programs. And I found that this was something that really sparked energy from me, something that really got me excited to be a part of, because you could see the work in the community, you're connecting with others that are passionate about making a difference. So I did that. You know, I always like to joke that my first board experience was when I was 14 and I was on a board, but actually it was a youth board. But I thought, wow, I've arrived. I'm a big boss. I'm on a board. And, you know, it was with Interfaith Ministries. And from then, I, of course, graduated from high school, moved on to college, went to St. Thomas University, which is also a small private Catholic school, more Mass. But at St. Thomas, I focused on international development, finance, economics. My thought was, you know what, I'm going to mobilize resources so that no one will ever go hungry. Right? No one will ever feel disenfranchised. No one will have to sacrifice their seat at the table. So that was where I wanted to focus on. Of course, trying to keep my halal hat on, right, the whole time, thinking, okay, how do I get into money and getting money to the right place without having to kind of sell my soul, right? So that was kind of a dance that I did through school. Finished early, graduated in a little over 3 years. Just because I'm an intense person, Muhi knows that. I'm just go, go, go. What day is it? 8 cylinders. Let's get her done. So did that.
And truck month in Texas.
Yeah, the truck. Go big or go home. Sometimes my southern accent will come out, Muhi, so don't get shocked and surprised. So anyway, so was in school and trying not to date myself. But during this time, the Arab Spring also took off. And as you might remember, obviously that was just like a firework across the world. And, you know, either you were doing something or you were not. And it seemed like silence was complacency and accepting authoritarian, unacceptable behavior. So anyway, during that time, I did some protest. I had my megaphone on the street and we were doing our first fundraiser. And at that time, I actually worked with some of my mentors now from Islamic Relief and other kind of relief organizations and raised over $200,000 in one night. And it was a very eye-opening experience, right? That people are willing to put their money where their mouth is when it comes to impact. And, you know, it was just something that I was actually just again, very energized to do. So I realized that, you know, fundraising was a skill set of mine at that very beginning. I'm pretty sure there's some background noise, apologies, but this is work
it's
from
the
life.
World we live in, no worries.
From life, yeah. Work from home life, so apologies. I'll just lean in a little closer. So, then I decided to go to grad school. And I went to Columbia University in New York. I was newlywed, very confused, and very tired. That's all I remember, really, from those 2 years, being confused and tired, but really excited about the work that I was learning to do. Did my master's in economic and political development, focusing on management, Had a chance to work with the United Nations in Jordan and different organizations also in New York that were focused on, again, mobilizing resources, making sure they went to the people that needed it. Finished grad school and worked with a tech startup in New York City, running their social impact department. So what does that mean, social impact department? Well, at the time, you know, social impact and social enterprise, all these buzzwords were coming out of the woodworks. And, you know, it was just such an exciting time. How can we be in a for-profit business and still do good, right? We heard right. words like the triple bottom line, you remember, and, you know, environment and social and all these things. So I ran the social impact department for a minority-owned, women-owned business, one of the top 10 women in the U.S. to raise over $1 million in seed funding. She was a 25-year-old CEO running a over $10 million for-profit business. So it was a very, very exciting time. I was in Harlem working with education initiatives. And then I decided, you know what, it's time to come back to Texas. So after a few years doing that, came back to Texas and met Suzanne, which I know Muhi has met her as well. And as he mentioned earlier, that was when I started working as his executive director and that's when I met Muhi. So how is the background noise, Muhi? It's acceptable or should
it's we? It's totally okay. Don't worry.
Okay, great. So anyway, so moving on, worked with as an executive director for this nonprofit. We didn't even have a name when it started. So in the spirit of entrepreneurship and startups, it was actually a startup nonprofit. And so I know a lot of professionals worry about startups and something that's smaller, but actually it's such a great opportunity to learn every single thing, right? And Muhi knows this because he's also a bootstrap startup person. But you get to wear all the hats, right? I was marketing, I was programs, I was the board liaison, I was all these things. And it helped me, you know, I was talking about how I would write the grants for $100,000 and I would also, you know, take out the trash, right? And that's okay because, you know, that's what you got to do. You're building something, right? You need to just, you know, be open to doing everything. So did that for a number of years and then went overseas for a little bit, came back, and now I'm in the consulting space. And it's, you know, it's been definitely, you know, all over the place experience. But when you look back, everything I did was exactly like I said, that personal mission of mobilizing funds to get them in the right place, whether that's programs, whether that's students in Harlem, whether that's women in, you know, the outskirts of Jordan, it was always focused on making sure that we have the resources that we need to make sure that people have a chance to have a full and healthy, robust, purposeful life, right? So now that's what I do now every day, which is really exciting. Usually we have about 5, 6, 7 clients per consultant. And it's, you know, it's never a dull moment. We have a moment where I'm working with an education organization, human needs, and then arts and culture, right? So it's a very diverse, challenging experience, but I'm really, really grateful for this opportunity. So that's my life story in a nutshell, Muhi, background noise and craziness.
Well, that's part of the story too, right? There's always these things in the background happening. I love the fact that, you know, even early on from your teen years through now, like you just had that purpose and mission and vision, and you've integrated it into everything that you've done. So I think that's very telling of like how you live your life and want to be making an impact. So tell us a little bit about Dinosphere and some of the services that they offer so that people get an understanding of what it is to be a fundraising consultant.
Absolutely. No. And that's exactly right. That personal mission, that's the first thing I tell anyone who's interested in getting into the space. You have to know your personal mission. What is your bucket of impact? What is your purpose when it comes to making an impact? So as I said, with nonprofit consulting, specifically with Genie Spheris, it's such an interesting experience because the firm has been around 51 years. So it started 1969 when one individual decided to work on a campaign with Rice University, one of their first endowment campaigns. Richard Deeney was the founder. And he did this big campaign and he said, you know what, Houston really needs a firm that's able to show the best practices for fundraising, bring some of the, you know, best and bright minds in this space, different directors of development and advancement, and let them share their skill sets in a really kind of formulaic but also customized way so that each nonprofit, even though they're in the grind, the day-to-day grind, they have an opportunity to go to the next level. And sometimes, as we know, it's very hard to have enough people on your team to take you to the next level without breaking the bank. So having a consulting team is really strategic because you're able to get 3 to 5 people on your team for maybe the price of one development officer, which we know can be a pricey person. So it's really strategic, and we've had thousands of nonprofits since then. Like I said, 51 years, you know, the YMCAs of the world, the Boys and Girls Clubs, the universities, the colleges, all of almost every nonprofit you can think of, big and small, in the Houston area, but also nationally from St. Louis to Chicago, as well as East and West Coast that have worked with us. So the firm does, you know, kind of a menu of items from campaign planning to campaign counsel, strategic planning, working with annual operating as well as capital campaigns. So kind of anything that a nonprofit might need, you know, even from their board training, to make sure that the four pillars of fundraising are supported, which is, of course, leadership, prospects, infrastructure, and what did I say infrastructure, leadership, prospects, and then one more that I'll remember once I've had my next coffee. So there's a few, so making sure that each of those are supported.
Mm-hmm. That's really great. In terms of just your continued career growth, you've mentioned you've had mentors and we're in this knowledge sharing group. What does it mean to you to have that support?
Oh, mentors are things that you cannot, I mean, there is no way to be successful in any space, in my personal opinion, without mentorship, because it's an opportunity to leapfrog, right? It's an opportunity to learn from someone who might have had a decade or two decades of experiences and mistakes that they can share that knowledge with you. So I take mentorship very seriously. It was one of our main programmatic offerings at Leyva when I was executive director there. I have what I call a list of rock stars that I lunch with at least quarterly or once a year. And I just say, hey, tell me everything you know, or this is what I'm going through. Should I panic? What are your thoughts? And to have those safe spaces like our learning circle with Gulam and Miri, you know, and Wedda and all them, it's such a great asset, because sometimes we just get in our heads and we don't know if we're doing it the right way, if we're being successful, what does success mean? So it is really so invaluable to have mentorship in your professional and your personal life.
Yeah, for sure. And it's something that I've also benefited greatly from. And even this peer-to-peer learning, like a mentor doesn't have to be somebody who is much older than you or has been in the career longer than you. Definitely helpful. But even just the peer-to-peer aspect of we're all kind of in the same space in our career and going through these things, but definitely can learn from your shared experiences. So I found great benefit in just continuously having opportunities to chat with people in the same nonprofit space. In terms of, you know, these fundraising trends or philanthropy in general, you know, I just did a presentation with the Muslim Network in New Jersey on financial sustainability. And we talked through different concepts of basics of fundraising. You know, there's an annual fund, a capital campaign, a major gift program, and these different areas to focus on as opposed to just like hosting a single event to do all of your fundraising. So what do you suggest nonprofits and learn about in terms of the best way that they can create like a strategic plan or a development plan? And, you know, whether it's partnering with a agency like Dinisphere's or having the capacity to hire a few part-time people or full-time people on their staff to lead them through this, what are the things a nonprofit should be looking for as they build out their strategy for their team?
Absolutely. That's a great question. So make sure I understand. So your question is how can a nonprofit, whether they have the capacity to partner with a firm or part-time talent, work to build those basic foundational steps towards a strategic plan or a development plan, correct?
Yeah.
So really it's about starting with your mission and your vision. I know it sounds so cliche, but sometimes, especially when we've been, you know, in the day-to-day grind of doing our programs or fundraising, we forget what our fundamental purpose is as an organization. We get mission creep where we run after the dollars and we forget about what we're originally chartered to do, right? So revisiting that mission is really the best place to start. Sometimes that mission needs to be reworked, right? And thinking that maybe this is too broad, maybe it's not actually the niche that we have as an organization. You know, maybe there's opportunity to improve and refine this. And then of course, everyone in the organization needs to be able to regurgitate that mission because they're thinking about it all the time. So we think about this mission when we build the strategic plan and when we build the development plan. So having those conversations with your team and your leadership and your board and making sure that there's some consistency with this culture of philanthropy and as well as the mission being integrated in all layers of the work. So that mission piece, of course, is crucial. The second piece is communicating and clarifying across the board, making sure that everybody's on the same page. And then finally, you know, having a conversation and some trainings, like organizations that have resources like the American Muslim Community Foundation, which have webinars. There's so many free or discounted resources out there to kind of provide a template or at least hear from experts in the field to kind of start structuring and framing what that strategic plan will look like. And then, of course, looking at our historical data as well when it comes to the development plan. For example, who has given to us in the past? What have we missed? You know, individuals, corporations, foundations, really kind of being reflective. Those are really the most important parts. And I think, and I could talk about this for hours, as Uhi knows, which I've done with his social impact group. So we cannot underestimate the importance of planning. You know, I think often we want to jump in, but, you know, it is totally normal to take months and months to plan these things, and that's okay, and it's needed. And every organization needs time to recalibrate and revisit, you know, these documents. It's not something we just put in our dusty file cabinet, right? It's something that we really need to be a living, breathing document, two of these documents. So that's kind of the very first thought when you're thinking about building a strategic plan and a development plan.
That's super helpful. Thank you for walking through that and many more tidbits in the Social Impact Accelerator webinar that we'll also share with people in case they're interested in learning more. You know, when it comes to just philanthropy and building relationships with donors, what are some insights that you would like to share, you know, whether it's a corporation, foundation, individual, you know, you've had experience dealing with donors. Share some advice for people who maybe don't have development staff and they're really stretched thin and they're that one staff member doing everything. How can you share some advice to help them focus more on building relationships and fundraising?
That's a great question. I've definitely been there. You've been there. We've all been there where we are just spread thin. And unfortunately, there's a few organizations that we don't know the power of paying our people and having enough people. So we end up just being tired and burnt out all the time. So that's the chronic illness that our industry has, which we could talk about for days as well. But assuming again that we don't have the resources and the people to do fundraising, it can be so overwhelming, right? This idea that, oh my gosh, I have to go ask somebody for $1 million. Where do I even start? I would just take a step back, take a deep breath and say that, you know, we are in the business of people. That is what nonprofit work is about. You are in the business of impacting people's lives, right? So each of you, you know, as a professional in this space, already have the foundational skill sets that are needed for successful fundraising. What is that? Having this passion for your mission, that is contagious. That's your case for support, which was the fourth pillar that I just now remembered because I had a sip of my coffee. So you have that passion to articulate that mission. And if you can effectively tell your story to someone who is interested, maybe has the linkage, the interest, and the ability to give, that's it. You've done fundraising. You've succeeded. You've arrived, right? So being able to translate your passion into a story is the very first element. And anyone can do that in an organization if they understand the mission. So that's the one piece that I would always tell people, just to empower them to say, you don't have to have, you know, CFRE behind your name like we do to get this to be effective, right? You just need to be able to convey that passion. And then the second piece is to talk about how, again, it's a relationship, it's a long play, right? Just like business development and sales and all these things in the private sector space, we are in the business of relationships. And this will take a long time, 12, 24 months to make a relationship translate into some dollars. So, you know, we need to remind our boards of that. We need to remind ourselves of that, that stewardship and cultivation when it comes to fundraising is a long play. And so we need to be kind to ourselves and realistic with our expectations to understand that this is, a longer situation. And I will end with this. I always like to tell people that the number of zeros that you want on your check is the number of times you need to meet with this prospective donor. Right, a lunch, a volunteer activity, an opportunity to engage with them. And so think about if you want a six-figure gift, you really need to be cultivating in an intentional, authentic way on a number of occasions. So those are two kind of tidbits.
I love that last one especially. And I think something also should be said around, even if you are that one person on the staff, rely on other people, engage other people in your organization to help you through it. And that's meaning your board members, your volunteers, your other staff members who can tell the story of the organization, and making sure that, even if you give, say, 5 or 10 donors as a portfolio for each board member, and just say, hey, can you, on a quarterly basis, reach out to these people? I'll create an email script, a text message, or some sort of means for you to just engage with the person. And that'll be part of their cultivation and stewardship, right? It's letting those donors know that you thank them, you appreciate them. It's having the board members ask them, like, what motivated the donor's gift, why they continue to support the organization, how they'd like to stay in touch. Those key basic informational questions can serve as like a discovery meeting for that donor. And then you get that information, you put it into an Excel sheet or a CRM or anywhere where it just lives on, so that, you know, as we continue to grow and maybe leave the organization or come back to the organization, that information stays with the organization and not just one person. And I think it's critical to say that because the development person at an organization, their average lifespan is about 18 months. So when you think about it and you're saying these relationships take 12 to 24 months to form, it's like people cycle through these positions and leave the organization. Somebody else comes in and has to do the same exact thing. It's helpful to have those tidbits and notes in the system so that people can continue where other people left off.
You made a great point about the board. People forget that a board is supposed to be in the field, on the bench, or in the bleachers. Ideally in the bleachers, your biggest fans that are out there in the community that are cheerleading for you, that are telling your story. And that is really one of the primary roles of a board. People forget that. The role of a board is to give time, treasure, and talent. They have to be out there working. I know, preach, sister. No, but it's true. I'm tired of saying this, but we have to remember that the board's role is to fundraise as well. So they should be out there, exactly like you said, building those relationships, and they don't have to make the ask. They probably shouldn't be making the ask. That's something that the development officer can do. But, you know, they are building those relationships for you. They're building that prospect pipeline. They are the leadership of the organization. And so it is something that you do not have to do alone. But to your point, absolutely, keeping good notes, you know, being clear about how this relationship has been managed is also extremely crucial.
But I think, you know, especially in making the ask, that's where a lot of board members get hesitant, right? But if they are the best peer-to-peer person for that donor, really encourage them to. Because 9 times out of 10, the board member has already given to the organization, maybe in a major gift way, so they can talk to that experience of why they support, why they're on the board. All those things are critical in building the relationship with these donors who you want to ask for funding. And I think that the more touch points the donor has, they see the full scope of the organization as well. So it just builds the trust there as well. I know you and I can nerd out about this for hours. And I definitely love every opportunity I get to connect with you. But I wanted to also shift gears a little bit and just ask you what some of your favorite nonprofits are that you and your family personally give your zakat and sadaqah to.
That's a great question. Thank you, Muhi. And absolutely, we should do a whole 12-point series on boards. So please consider.
It's needed. Yeah. So much to learn. And I would say anybody who's listening, send this to your board members and go to the 28-minute mark and have them start listening, because it's critical for them to understand how important they are in the fundraising and development process.
Absolutely. And don't apologize. So yes, my favorite nonprofits, you know, again, being a Houstonian, the Houston Food Bank has been so crucial, especially recently, you know, when it comes to the blizzard and food scarcity. We also love Medical Bridges, which is an organization that donates medical supplies overseas to different, you know, hospitals in need. That's really near and dear to our family's heart. We really give to many health initiatives. Health is something, obviously, if you're not healthy, you can't do anything. So health, food scarcity, and women's organizations. So one that comes to mind is Dress for Success. A great organization with women reentering the workforce. So those are a few that just come to mind, but those are kind of the main initiatives that we are interested in. And of course, a few Islamic organizations as well that do great work.
I love that. Yeah. And, you know, even the ISP research, we had Petra El Soufi on the podcast recently, and she was talking about the Muslim Philanthropy Report that was done. Showcasing that Muslims equally give to organizations outside of our faith community than we do to Muslim institutions as well. So this is a prime example of that. And since you mentioned the Houston Food Bank, I do also want to showcase that one of the first gifts in 2017 that American Muslim Community Foundation made was to the Houston Food Bank after Hurricane Harvey, Hurricane Irma, Hurricane Maria, went through Texas and the Gulf Coast. And it was critical to us because we were newly founded at that time, and we made a really small gift, just $1,000. But the fact that the check said American Muslim in the name of it, the board member from Houston Food Bank reached out and said, "This gift is so meaningful to us to know that the Muslim community cares about the work that we do." And to me, that was very telling. And I love that story of impact, because although it was one family's generosity, the entire Muslim community got the benefit of it. And I think that's the power of working with American Muslim Community Foundation in the philanthropy that we do. When you entrust us with your zakat, we redistribute it to organizations that are in need. So it's a really big honor for us to showcase the impact that Muslim philanthropy can have.
I agree, absolutely. And what a good example of stewardship and cultivation of a gift as well. But that's
exactly,
that's
yeah. That board member didn't have to reach out, right? But they chose to, and that is something that we'll be so appreciative of. And we've continued to support the Houston Food Bank every single year. So it's something that we recognize, and something that each of your organizations should do is, you know, set a policy that anytime a gift comes in, you're thanking those donors within 24 hours, whether it's a special email beyond the automated receipt that they get, or if you only have an address, somebody writes a thank you card for gifts over a certain amount, whether that's $500 or $1,000, and maybe you do that on a monthly basis. Or you decide to, if it's a gift of $1,000 or more, you engage the executive director. Or if it's a gift of $5,000 or more, you engage the board. So again, these different touch points, because as we know, the gift life cycle, you know, the ask is only one small aspect of it. There's cultivation, there's stewardship, there's prospecting. Everything is a piece of that fundraising gift life cycle. And each of those components are more important than the ask, because you want to retain that donor year over year, and build that relationship with multiple entry points to the organization so that they get a better holistic understanding of the org itself. So, yeah.
Exactly. Well said, Ed.
You can tell I just did a presentation on this, so it's all fresh at the top of my head.
But all real and all right. So.
For sure. So is there anything else that you want to chat about in terms of fundraising, nonprofits, or just living the life?
Well, shameless plug, of course, you know, of course, DE Spheres is, you know, always available to help any nonprofits. I have a personal passion for supporting the Muslim space as well. It's one of my personal purposes and mission statements. So if there are, you know, even as an individual, as a professional, feel free to reach out. I'm sure Muhi can share my contact information. I'm happy to help with mentorship as well. People that are just starting into this space, you know, we have to help each other. And, you know, I don't believe in you don't have enough time. You know, I have a toddler who's actually my boss, my real boss. But we all can make time, you know, to help each other. And it can be a 15-minute call. And Muhi always says there's so much we can accomplish in 30 minutes. So, you know, there's just really do not hesitate to reach out to someone that you think you can learn from. So that's my closing remarks.
Yeah, definitely. And you can find more information on Dini Spheris at DiniSpheris.com. So DiniSpheris.com. And Nadine Mustafa is a fantastic resource. I highly recommend you find her on LinkedIn, you find her on Dini Spheris' website, and make sure to use their services. If you guys have a budget to have a consultant to help you with grant writing or help you with building a development plan or strategic plan, anything nonprofit related that you need, Dini Spheris can make it happen. So. A big thank you, Nadine, for spending some time with us. It's been a really insightful and engaging conversation, and really appreciate your time and using your skill set, your time, talent, and treasure for the community. So thank you so much.
Well, it's been such a pleasure and such an honor to be on the podcast, Muhi, and thank you again for all that you do for our community, and just excited to be a part of it. So there's so much work to be done, but we can do it together. So. Hopefully, likewise. This will be the first of many partnerships in the future.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.
Bye.